Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing.
And Bubba Wallace.
You know what's the worst part of a race? A rain delay.
Sitting around, waiting for the track to dry, is dull.
But instead of waiting, we hang out with Chumba Casino.
Social casino slots, bingo, solitaire, plenty of fun to keep us entertained.
So why let a rain delay slow you down? Play now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
It's the Amazing Rico Bronya Podcast with your host, Evan Roberts.
Wow, we're allowed to do a happy Rico Bronya? It's okay? It's okay to talk about the Mets winning. How about that? For the very first time since the middle of June, when the Mets won 2 out of 3 against the Atlanta Braves to pull within 7 games of .500, for the first time since then, the Mets win a series. They win 2 out of 3 against the Kansas City Royals, and we get a chance to talk about it. And they win 2 out of 3 after losing a game on Tuesday that was as bad, as humorous, as depressing, as bizarre, whatever word you want to use. They respond to that insane 16-12 loss with back-to-back wins against this Kansas City Royals. They win 2 out of 3. And they head to the final series before the All-Star break with a chance to, let's say, have a positive homestand by beating the red-hot Boston Red Sox. We got a lot to talk about. We will read your emails. We'll pick the Rico, I'm the man right now. We'll pick the net negative. And we'll go through mostly game 2 and 3 of this series. We did a drive-home Rico Bronya right after they lost 16-12. So I have a couple of final thoughts about that game, but we went more in-depth on that, or at least our instant reaction to it a couple of days ago, if you want to go back one episode to episode 720. What we noticed in this series, and this includes game 1 against Kansas City, and really what you've noticed over the last few weeks with this team, is that they're actually scoring runs. I mean, especially the tail end of the Atlanta series, because they did struggle to score at the beginning of the Atlanta series. They didn't hit much in the Toronto series. But if you look at the last 2 games against the Braves, when they put up the 17 runs in 2 games, they come out against Kansas City and they put up 12, 6, and 7. 6, 7, sorry. I got my kids in my head. This offense has clicked. This offense has played well over the last couple of days. So maybe we get to retire LD offense, at least for the time being. And there are a lot of reasons for that. A lot of guys that deserve credit for that. Even some of the guys that maybe don't just come to mind first, because I think the guys that are going to come to mind first is the outfield. And I think that's probably right now, as a Met fan, the most encouraging thing we have: the emergence of AJ Ewing, the emergence of Carson Bench, and obviously Juan Soto having a really, really good season. So this is an outfield that's putting up big time production. But even a guy like Brett Beatty, who we love to crap on, rightfully so, had a hit in every game in this series. Brett Beatty produced, Jared Young has produced, Francisco Alvarez has run into some hits. So it's been a collective effort from this Met offense. Unfortunately, in the opener of the series, the pitching was so atrocious that they couldn't make a 9-4 lead hold up. And they obviously gave up the 16 runs and managed to lose a game while scoring 12. But in the last 2 games of this series, and they both kind of followed a common trend, which is it's a close game, and then the offense puts it away at some point. We saw in game 2 of this series a 1-1 game all the way into the bottom of the 8th inning, and then with 2 outs and nobody on, putting together a rally, a really impressive rally that featured the 2-out hit from Francisco Lindor, a really good at-bat from Carson Bench, the infield hit by Jorge Polanco, and then obviously they break the game open after the hit batsman with the 2-run single by Beatty, the RBI single by Alvarez, and they turn what was a nail-biter into a pretty comfortable victory on Wednesday night. But going to game 2, and we'll start there, we'll get to game 3, and we'll get to all the normal doings and going-ons of Rico Bronya. But when I go to game 2, there is something I want to address because it annoyed me. Now, it didn't annoy me to the level where I want the man traded, which some of you guys do. It didn't get to the level of bench his ass, but it got to the level of why did that happen? So in the 8th inning of game 2 of this series, and remember, the Met offense after the AJ Ewing home run did not do very much. So the LD offense, I guess, showed up for a period of time. Lindor, who's sitting to some bad luck because he ran into a hard luck out in the 3rd inning when he came up with 2 on and 2 out, drove one to deep right field, and Tyler Tolbert made that really good catch against the fence. So he's hitting some bad luck, but he also really hasn't hit since coming back off the IL, Lindor, and his defense has been shaky. He puts together a good at-bat with two outs and nobody on in the eighth inning, singling to right field. Great. Fantastic. Starts a rally. You never know what a two-out rally can lead to. Carson Benj then has a really, really impressive at-bat in which he draws a 9-pitch walk against Alex Lang, the former Detroit Tiger. All good so far. Jorge Polanco, welcome back, Jorge. Almost forgot you existed. Activated a few days ago and almost hit that home run in game one. The one that was called a home run. It was overturned. Either way, Jorge Polanco's looked halfway decent at the plate. Chops one to first base and beats one out for an infield hit. But the flip to first base was a bad throw. It was the first baseman, whoever was playing first base at that time for Kansas City. Caliglione makes the bad throw to first base with the pitcher covering. And Lindor doesn't score. And I was stunned. I was not at this game. I was watching the game on TV like most people. And I was stunned after the bad throw that he didn't score. So good job by SNY. They show the replay. Like, had it happen? Was he just being conservative? Was he afraid of his arm? Because Caliglione plays a lot of right field, has a very good arm. So maybe that was some self-scouting by Lindor. And you see he's not running. You see that even with there being two outs, even with there being first and second two outs in a tie game in the bottom of the eighth inning, and a chopper is hit to first base, in which that play can happen. A bad throw can absolutely happen. I'll take it a step further. You could run through it anyway and try to catch the first baseman or pitcher completely off guard. So there's no reason not to be hustling. This is not, you know, a routine ground ball to second base. I think this is far worse than what Soto was given crap for earlier this season when he didn't run out of ground ball to second that got booted. And you see the replay, and he's just not running. And I don't know what it is. I'm not going to come up with some crazy theory here on the Rico. I'm just going to say that not running on that play is unacceptable. I'm not going to go hyperbolic. I'm not going to say they got to trade him for a bunch of prospects, need half his salary. But Lindor, and I don't know what it is. Again, I don't want to come up with 100 different theories on the why. I just know that when Lindor has played this season, he's done a lot of things that normally he doesn't do. The defense, fine. He's missed a lot of time. But the forgetting how many outs there were early in this season, he doesn't normally do that. Lindor's a smart player. And I think when it comes to hustling, I'd say he hustles more time than he doesn't. I haven't felt since Francisco got here in 2021 that he lacks hustling on a consistent basis. I haven't felt that way. So that was inexcusable. And luckily, it turned out to be an afterthought. Like, I could have gotten away with not bringing it up, right? The Mets won the game. They ended up scoring 5 runs in the bottom of the eighth inning, and it probably would have been forgotten. If Jared Young doesn't get hit by a pitch, which drove in the lead run, and then you don't get the wild pitch and the base hits and everything that blew that game open in the bottom of the eighth inning, I think the Lindor lack of hustle is a major talking point. It's something we are talking more about. So I don't have an answer for it, and I don't know if Andy Green sits him down or says anything, but that stuff can't happen. I don't care what their record is. I don't care how much money you're making. You got to be better than that. So bad job by Francisco Lindor, but great job by Jared Young sticking his elbow out. I think of when I see a guy get hit by a pitch with the bases loaded in a spot in which it's very borderline that you even got hit. I think of Michael Conforto on opening day. I don't know if that's a memorable opening day, but it was 2021. It was the home opener. It was the COVID year, or at least I guess 2021 isn't considered the COVID year. 2020 is. But 2021 began with stadiums that featured 10,000 people. It was a very weird beginning to the season. So the home opener that year against the Marlins, the only home opener I have missed in about 35 years. I did not go to that home opener. I was doing the afternoon show with Craig at the time, and I didn't skip out. It was the one I missed, but I made the excuse in my head that it was okay because I went to the Mets season opener a few days earlier in Philadelphia against the Phillies. So I was able to play the mental gymnastics of not being at that game. But that was the game where Michael Conforto, with the bases loaded, I think it was the bottom of the ninth inning. It was whatever. It walked the game off, kind of stuck his elbow out, got hit by the pitch, and that's how the Mets won the game. Is it cheap? I don't really care. I mean, who cares if it's cheap? Score a run. That's all that matters. And Jared Young did just that. on Wednesday night. But what I love to see was the Met offense putting the hammer down. The Met offense saying, all right, great. We got the lead. Now we're going to get more. Brett Beatty behind in the count. Behind in the count, ripping a line drive to right center field that drove into Francisco Alvarez, ripping a base hit in the left field. Very encouraging stuff by the Met offense. And that was off of, I would say, some curious decisions from Andy Green when it involved his bullpen. So Christian Scott goes five scoreless. He throws 90 pitches. I can't bitch about it. I just can't. He's coming off of Tommy John surgery. The Mets have been very careful with him. You're naive or you're not paying attention if you were surprised that Christian Scott was taken out after five. I did think it was kind of cool that Andy Green, in a way, questioned Scott a little bit. Like, he put him over and said, hey, you did a great job, but I know you can go deeper into this game. And he went through specific moments in the game where if Christian Scott was more efficient or more aggressive and he got a quicker out and didn't nibble and didn't fall behind, where maybe that pitch count wouldn't have been at 90 through five, maybe it would have been at 78, and you're able to go to the sixth inning. So I like that he called him out. I thought that was kind of cool. It was good to see. It's something we're obviously not used to because it's not like we're used to managers all of a sudden calling out their players. But Christian Scott was really good. Like, I'll take the five scoreless innings. Yes, at some point you need to see him go deeper into games, but five good innings. When he got into trouble, which wasn't often, he was able to make the big pitch, put two guys on in the second inning, got Tyler Tolbert out, which is impossible to do, but got him to pop up the second base, gave up a two-out hit in the fourth, had a 1-2-3 fifth inning. It was a really encouraging outing by Christian Scott. Christian Scott, I know I got crap from a few of you for ever mentioning Zach Wheeler, and I know Hoff did like a label, we found our next Zach Wheeler. I would love if he turns into Zach Wheeler. I'm not telling you he is, even if that headline said that. It's that he reminds me of Zach Wheeler. And I don't know if it's just the windup, or if it's the number 45, or it's the stuff, or it's the body, or it's the back of his head with the center field view. I'm not sure if it's all of it. Maybe it's every small thing. Or maybe if it's even the Tommy John surgery. You know, I went on a little bit, and I could do a whole Rico about this, but I went off a little bit about On the Fan the other day, how losing Zach Wheeler bothers me more and more by the day, the decision for the Mets to not aggressively try to re-sign him in free agency. And I don't know, maybe that's a part of it too, that we went through so much with Zach Wheeler, went through a lot of downs, some ups, injuries, patience with young pitching, and then to not reap the ultimate benefits really, really sucks. And I think to a degree, with Scott coming up, being sort of impressive but struggling, getting hurt, waiting a long time. Now he's back from Tommy John. We're very careful with him. I guess the scar tissue reminds me of Zach Wheeler. But hopefully someday Christian Scott's going to be able to learn how to go deeper into games, something Zach is certainly able to do at this advanced stage of his career. But five really good innings out of Christian Scott. Here's what I didn't get. And I get the bullpen situation based on what happened on Tuesday. They recalled Tobias Myers. I almost forgot Tobias Myers existed. I do recall being lectured quite a bit on the Freddie Peralta trade when I criticized it. A lot of people said, well, don't forget Tobias Myers. How about Tobias Myers? Tobias Myers. And I said, yeah, it's a fine addition. And for about a month, Tobias Myers was a really good addition. I don't know what happened. He's been awful since. He comes into this game nursing a 1-0 lead. And I get it's unrealistic to expect that the Mets are going to make a 1-0 lead hold up as good as their bullpen's been. Are you really going to get 27 outs from Christian Scott in the Met bullpen and hold a 1-0 lead? No, the Mets needed more than that. But they go to Tobias Myers in the sixth inning. He gives up a one-out double to Caglione, gets a really good defensive play behind him by Bo Bichette. He's an out away from getting through the sixth inning. And he's facing Salvador Perez. And I'll tell you something completely irrational, and I'm owning it. I own it because I say it's irrational. Salvador Perez has been this season one of the worst offensive players in baseball. Just has. I get it. His numbers are his numbers. He's at the advanced age that he's at. But when Salvador Perez came up with a base open and two outs in the sixth inning, there was a part of me that said, don't face him. That is, I guess, the mental issues I still have from the 2015 World Series. It's the respect I have for him. It's, I guess, my lack of respect for Michael Massey, who I guess I should have respect for because the day before he got on base four times. It's not like he's some kind of bum. But I was scared of Salvi in that spot. And I had very little confidence that Tobias Myers was going to get that third out of the sixth inning. And Perez kept battling and he fouled pitches off over and over again. And then he dunks a base hit to left field. And it was a buzzkill. It was a buzzkill because Christian Scott loses the opportunity to win a game. But the way the Met offense had kind of slowed down after the home run by Ewing, and obviously all the runs they scored the night before, was the bullpen going to be able to hold up? And was the offense going to be able to score a run? But I don't even hate Andy Green going to Tobias Myers, because when you go to your bullpen in the sixth inning, and yeah, you in theory have Raleigh, Weaver, and Devin available, you don't have much else. So I viewed Myers in the sixth more as a bridge, as he's just got to get it to the formula. And in my mind, the formula was going to be Raleigh, Weaver, and Devin, because those guys didn't pitch the day before. They were unavailable. So I'm assuming game two of this series, Mets need a win to at least make sure they don't lose this series, that those guys would be available. I was very surprised that Andy Green allowed Tobias Myers to start the seventh inning. He has a 6 ERA. He just allowed a run. I didn't get it at all. And to make matters worse, he gives up a leadoff double to Nick Lofton. And I got to tell you, I'm annoyed. I don't understand why Andy Green is allowing Tobias Myers to pitch a second inning. I don't get it. I have one of these emails. I'll interject with the email because I'm remembering it, where someone wonders, was Myers pitching a second inning squarely because they're trying to stretch him out? Here's the email from Jeremy. Jeremy writes, it's 1-1 in the seventh, and Tobias Myers is going back out for a second inning. Are the Mets more focused on stretching out Tobias's pitch count rather than trying to win the game? I would have thought that, Jeremy, if this was a few weeks ago, but I think Myers has been so inconsistent that I no longer think the Mets are focusing on stretching him out. I think they're focused on just having a live arm, because after the game, he was sent back down. Tobias Myers, and I did not see this coming, but obviously his performance has dictated this. Tobias Myers is on the Syracuse shuttle. I never would have thought that at the beginning of the season, especially with the way he's pitched or the way he was pitching earlier this season. But he is now one of those up and down guys. And so because of that, Jeremy, no. I think the last time he was here, I would have thought that they started to prioritize. I think I even made that point that they were trying to prioritize stretching him out more than anything else. But I'm pulling up his numbers. It's kind of amazing. If you go back to April 28th, his ERA was 2.33. In fact, let's move forward to May 2nd. He had just pitched 2 2/3 scoreless innings through 36 pitches, faced 12 batters, got most of them out, and lowered his ERA to 2.05. That's on May 2nd. So for a good month, and in every outing, he's going two or three innings. Like, he's the stretched out multi-inning reliever. And then I don't know what changed, but on May 6th, in a game that the Mets won against the Rockies, I vaguely remember this, he came in and just couldn't get anybody out. He gave up 2 home runs in 2/3 of an inning, 5 hits, and his ERA jumped all the way up to 3.57. And really, since then, he has not been good. In fact, I'm looking at his outings. He has had 4 outings in which he hasn't allowed a run, and 11 outings in which he has. Imagine that. That's how bad he's been. So I don't even think it's about stretching him out now. I think it's the fact that he just hasn't been effective. And because of that, well, let me rephrase that. I think the reason they asked him to pitch a second inning is because they were trying to steal another 3 outs. That even though I thought Raleigh was available and Weaver was available and Devin was available, I think Andy Green is also thinking about the following day and the following day and the following day. Like, he probably didn't want to have to use all 3 of those relievers in one game. And ultimately he didn't, because he stretched another inning out of Myers. And after Raleigh pitched a scoreless eighth inning, the Mets blew the game open in the bottom of the eighth inning. So they ended up going to Xavien Curry and not needing to go to one of their key relievers. So I don't think Myers was asked to pitch another inning to stretch him out. I think he was asked to pitch another inning because they're trying to find outs and innings anywhere they can. It's like looking for pennies underneath the couch cushions. You're just looking to find outs from anywhere you can find it. And I think based on Myers coming out for the seventh, as much as I thought the formula was available, Andy Green really didn't want to use the formula. Now, credit to Myers, after he gives up that leadoff double, he's able to get out of it, including getting Bobby Witt Jr. to fly out to right field with two on and two out. So ultimately, he got the job done. Brooks Raley got the job done working around the one-out double, and obviously the offense broke the game open in the bottom of the eighth inning. Xavien Curry came in. How you doing, Xavien? Very cool to write X and Z back-to-back. And the Mets win game two of this series by a final score of 6-2. Nice victory. Fun victory. If you went to Citi Field and you went to the night before's game, you were at least given back the pain of the 16-12 loss. You got the A.J. Ewing home run. You got some clutch hitting. The bullpen outside of Tobias Myers did a decent job. Christian Scott gives you the five scoreless. And the Mets win a baseball game by a final score of 6-2. Let me read some of your other emails from Game 2, the RicoB at gmail.com. John writes, Evan, longtime listener, first-time writer. Tonight's game, Game 2 of this series, against the Royals in the bottom of the eighth inning. Pete Alonso makes a guest appearance at first base for the Royals and opens up the floodgates for the Mets. I miss his bat for sure, but I don't miss my balls being in my throat every time he had to toss a throw to first base. Written very oddly, John, but I get your point. You're taking a shot at Alonso's biggest flaw, which is throwing balls to first base. I agree with you. Like, I love Pete. That was one of his biggest issues. Brian writes, despite your constant critiques of Jared Young's defensive acumen at first base, Keith Hernandez, the 11-time Gold Glove winner, who's widely regarded as the greatest to ever play the position defensively, said he has played a, quote, very nice first base, very, very sure-handed. Find a new slant to criticize Stearns and bemoan losing your favorite greedy Oriole. Brian, I appreciate your creativity. I've also heard Keith Hernandez, who I do respect his acumen at first base. I was pretty good defensively at first base back in my day, but I was no Keith Hernandez. But I've also heard Keith say about Jared Young, he's not a first baseman. So he's complimented him, but he's also reminded us that he's learning the position. So what I would reconsider, Brian, is that Keith Hernandez may be grading Jared Young's defense slightly on a curve. Because Keith has acknowledged quite a bit, not just about Young, but about Vientos and Beatty, the rare times he's gone over there, is that these are not natural first basemen. And my critiques of Jared Young, I don't think has been mean at all. It's just been that he's not very good. Now, I agree with Keith's assessment that he's not a first baseman. He's learning the position. Two things can be true at the same time. He's not great. The Met defense at first base overall, whether it's Young or it's Vientos or it's Beatty, have been well below average. Will I give Young credit for the fact that he's learning and is doing a better job over there than Mark Vientos? Sure. But let's not pretend like the Mets haven't lost something defensively at first base. And that's not a slant to rip David Stearns. That's just the reality. That's just the way it's been. If you're watching, you know that. Let's get to the Lindor lack of hustle. This from Rob. Evan, I know where you stand on the issue regarding Lindor, but after watching this game tonight, my mind has changed. The poor fielding, the mental errors, the lack of hitting are bad enough. The lack of paying attention and hustle have led me to change of heart. Originally, I agreed with your stance. Replay showed that if he had been hustling to third base or even paying attention to the play, he could have scored. Luckily, it all worked out, and he scored after the hit by pitch. No excuse for him not scoring on the previous play. Even Keith said so. We restructured the whole team to accommodate him and his wife. Apparently, he did not even lift a finger to welcome Juan to the team when they acquired him. Then he got hurt when Cohen said there'll be no captain ever. You can tell his demeanor is different this year. No talking to the next batters or being a leader in any way. He hardly congratulated Ewing last night in the dugout after his hits. You can tell me You can't tell me some team would not take on 4 more years of Lindor to win now with him this or next year at $34 million. Cohen could pay it down a little if necessary. All right, a lot of things here. Number one, I still don't buy the theory that you're presenting, that a lot of people have presented, that the reason Alonso and Nimmo aren't here is Francisco Lindor. Like, there are obvious baseball reasons we've talked about, as much as I may disagree with it, on why they decided to let Pete go. They didn't want to give him a five-year deal. They didn't want to give him a five-year deal 2 years ago. They never wanted to give it to him. The only reason they brought him back last year is they got him on a short-term deal. I don't agree that trading Lindor in any way would make this team better. But I can acknowledge that this season has been weird for him, besides missing as much time as he's missed. Yeah, the lack of hustle on that play on Tuesday night, I can't explain it. I can't. His defense has been subpar. It's all true. But I also have a level of confidence based on how good he was last year, and 32 is not 37, that it's not all over for him. And so I would not be in a rush to make a trade in which I'm giving up so much value and paying down a big part of it because we've created these fictitious stories in our mind that everybody hates him and he doesn't want to be here and he got rid of everybody on this roster. You know, you can knock one out of the park the way Juan Soto did for a few days and raise the apple with Takara Chuhai, a sparkling cocktail that blends real shochu spirits with the delicious flavors of fruits locally grown in Japan. It's available at Citi Field and Fuji Apple, of course, white peach and lemon. Before we continue on and talk about game three, the matinee on Thursday afternoon that the Mets won, Pete Hoffman needs to address the masses. Because Pete, like me, we do agree on this, have been very pro Pete Alonso. We wanted him to come back. All understood. Now, Pete's taking it to another level. Apparently on social media, he tweets all the time about Alonso, reminding us what we are missing, and has become a pseudo-Oreo fan. Fine. I've tried to move on as best as I could. Hoff has taken a very different approach. But it was brought to my attention the other day, and I actually retweeted it because I thought it was necessary, that Pete Hoffman has been caught in a very infamous Posted and Toasted in which he used to rip Pete Alonso all the time. Before I give you a chance to defend yourself, let me show some examples. May 19th, 2023. Pete Alonso is overrated too. Not a superstar. The Mets don't have superstars. On July 3rd, 2025, if only we had a better first baseman who could fire a better throw home. Pete Alonso just isn't it. Never makes the big plays. Okay. August 29th, 2024, Pete Alonso with his empty stats. And then finally, on May 16th, 2024, prior to the OMG phenomenon, trade Pete Alonso while he's hot. Hoff, these tweets indicate that you used to hate Pete Alonso before you love Pete Alonso. Your chance to defend yourself.
So I appreciate whoever pulled those. I'm very glad that someone did half-assed homework. Because if you go to those dates, that I was quote-unquote criticizing Pete Alonso, you would see that he did something awesome. And it's called sarcasm, which clearly doesn't work on social media. The home run, or what was I saying, that the Mets don't have superstars, Pete Alonso is a superstar. He had a grand slam versus who the hell was it? Was it versus the Brewers or versus somebody?
I didn't do that kind of fact checking. If you're telling me that, I got to go back and look.
Yes. The game I'm talking about with his, oh, we need somebody who could make a better throw at first base. He makes two plays versus the Brewers, one which, by the way, the radio was kind of making fun of him. They were like, oh, he kind of made an unnecessary fall to the floor, and he made a play to first. And then there was no outs or one out, runner on third base. He's playing in, or a rocket gets hit to him, picks it up, throws the runner at home on a bullet. And I'm like, so this was also partly because when these tweets were taking place, I was with a host who, I'm just going to say it, Brandon Tierney. He ripped Pete Alonso on a regular basis. And he continued to say how Pete Alonso wasn't a superstar and kept on saying how Pete Alonso was no good. And I'm sorry. I watch him every freaking day. You can't tell me that. So I was sending out sarcastic tweets directed at Brandon Tierney, and he never read them, but Frankie did.
All right. So I fact checked one of them. Okay. The August 29th Pete Alonso with his empty stats tweet occurred when Pete Alonso hit a second inning home run that gave the Mets a 1-0 lead against the Diamondbacks. That game, I do remember, was the biggest, one of the biggest games of the season because yes. It was the rubber game against Arizona. It was the tiebreak game. That was the game they had to win to get the tiebreaker, and they won the game 3-2. And they won the game with a run in the ninth inning, and then Edwin Diaz held on. So I got to tell you, it does check out, ladies and gentlemen, that they are sarcastic Hoffman tweets.
And by the way, the other one where I say trade him, it's like May 16th and he's got like 10 home runs on the season. I'm like, it's sarcasm because all I heard was, oh, you know, this guy, he's not a good career Met. Get him out of here. Like, I take that to heart because how much I know, I thought this guy, he's going to be a Hall of Famer. He's a good first baseman. And guess what else I did for all the idiots out there? I put the Mets first base stats compared to Pete Alonso stats. People could say, oh, the numbers aren't that much off. 20 home runs to 14 home runs, 62 RBIs to 48 RBIs. The OPS is, by the way, completely different, like 809 to 650 or whatever it is. But there's one stat that's glaring. 11 errors to 2.
I think that, and this takes a lot of time and it's obnoxious, I totally admit it. But if we try to be fair, if that's our attempt, forget about what my opinion was, your opinion was, if we try to be fair about trades and free agent signings, judging it in year one is never going to be the answer. It's always going to be over the course of time. Like Pete Alonso signed a 5-year contract. The Mets would have brought him back this year. I mean, the Mets clearly in year one are losing the decision, but it doesn't mean they're going to lose the decision in year 3, year 4, and year 5. That's where things are determined, unfortunately. That's why I'm waiting one more year before we do the Jacob DeGrom, Rico, where we can break down if it would have been smart to give him a 5-year contract or not.
You just went off the other day on Zach Wheeler that you still can't get over.
Because now we know. That's why.
I know.
It took a while.
I know.
It took a long time to get the answer.
I know, but the frustrating thing is, Ev, I saw this a mile away with Pete Alonso, and it's very frustrating. And the first year has been a complete and utter failure. And I can't take a Kansas City Royals series serious when they're like the worst team in the league and we're the second worst team in the league and we're scraping by.
I understand. I get your point. All right, you've been cleared of all wrongdoing. It was Pete's attempt at sarcasm. That's what was going on.
Thank you.
Let's get to game 3 of this series on Thursday afternoon. I made a very interesting decision. I was going to take my youngest son, Spence, to this game. I took him to work, and then we were going to go to a game. But he's also been asking me to go to a theme park for a very long time. And I had promised him that I was going to take him to a theme park. So one possibility was going to the Met game and then a theme park. And then I realized, how about I just take him to the theme park? We go to enough freaking Met games. So I did not go to the Met game on Thursday afternoon. I actually DVR'd it. I watched it after we came back from a theme park. And for those that are curious, it was Rye Playland, which I had never been to, as close as I live there. It ain't Disney World, I'll tell you that. But it got the job done. There were rides. There was cotton candy. He was a happy boy. As far as the game is concerned, I sit down, get my scorecard ready. I think I started the game at about 5 o'clock on Thursday afternoon. And as I'm just putting the final nail on my scorebook to get it started, Lane Thomas hits a first pitch home run. And that always bothers me because every time, and it's happened a few times. I think it's already happened this year once or twice. But every time the Mets give up a first pitch home run at home in the top of the first inning, Derek Jeter dances through my head and it just ruins my day. It just completely ruins it. But how about your boy, my boy, our boy, Sean Manaea. The story of Sean Manaea in 2026 is fascinating, right? His velocity is down. He doesn't make the rotation. He's going to be a long man or a tag team. Remember that thought back in spring training that the Mets and Carlos Mendoza would use him in a tag team? Instead, he's a long man. And early on, he's an ineffective long man to the point where should they DFA him? Should they just write a check to get rid of him? What do you do? And then slowly but surely, he starts to be a little bit more impressive, you know, a little bit better, slowly but surely. And then finally, because of the state of the Met rotation, Sean Manaea gets a chance to be a bulk guy. And again, like, sort of impressive. And then a few weeks ago, they make him a full-time starter. What we saw in this particular game on Thursday afternoon, in a lot of ways, was the best of Sean Manaea. He gives up the leadoff home run to Lane Thomas. He gives up a 3-1 cookie to Bobby Witt Jr. for a bomb of a home run. But outside of that, I know he got into trouble in the seventh inning. We saw some glimpses of 2024 Sean Manaea. Now, he did get helped out by some base running miscues. Luis Torrens threw out Starling Marte trying to steal in the first inning. Sean Manaea himself picked off Tyler Tolbert to get out of the fifth inning. So a few of the outs he got were the Royals on the base paths. But hey, one of them was his doing, the pickoff, like I mentioned, of Tolbert. But he was really in command and pitched incredibly well, and he was efficient. And we talked earlier about Christian Scott, and that is something he needs to get better at. Sean Manaea was at 75 pitches through six innings, which I don't remember a Met pitcher being that efficient this season. And considering no Met has thrown a baseball in the eighth inning as a starter, no surprise, but he was great. He gets the first two outs of the seventh inning. And then what was frustrating, and I feel bad for, was the fact that he couldn't get that last out against Nick Lofton ahead of the count 1-2. He gives up a base hit. Then he gives up the double to Caglione. But if he was able to get Lofton out, there was a chance he was going to be able to pitch into the eighth inning. But he ran into trouble in the seventh. And this is where I commend Andy Green. I love this. I was managing along, even if the game was long over. Keep Manaea in. He gives up the single to Lofton. Soto makes a brutal error. More on that in a little bit. He gives up the RBI double. And I thought at that point, well, he's clearly going to take him out. And he didn't. He lets him face Isaac Collins, who he walks. And he still keeps him in and says, all right, Sean Manaea, go get Tyler Tolbert. Go get this big out, a guy who nobody has been able to get out in this series. Tolbert, of course, the guy who had the 12 consecutive hits, right? And for some reason, and I'll take it, we'll all take it, Tyler Tolbert is laying down a bunt, which I don't get at all. There's first and second and two outs. You bunting in this spot, what does that do? You're just prolonging the inning for the ninth place hitter. That's all you're doing. So even if he gets the bunt down successfully, it doesn't lead to anything other than, okay, now there's just another base runner. I guess maybe the thought is at 6-3, I'll be able to get the tying run on base. I don't know. Doesn't seem like a really good idea, but good job by Torrens pouncing on it. And so even if it took a little bit of luck from Manaea, because what did he do there? You know, he gives up the three straight base runners, and luckily Tolbert's bunting for some reason, but he was able to complete the seven innings. And in this day and age, with this team, with this rotation, seven completed innings from anybody not named Nolan McClain feels like a miracle. Kudos to Sean Manaea. I know it's creating thoughts in everyone's heads like, okay, what does this mean for next year? Look, it means the same thing it was going to mean if he was struggling. He's due $25 million. You may as well get the best out of it. I don't think even with a strong finish, his market would be huge if you're thinking of trading him. And honestly, I don't think I'd want to trade him. Not because I believe he's morphed into 2024 Sean Manaea, but the Mets are going to need arms for their rotation next year. We thought coming into this season they were going to have a lot of depth, and that depth got just absolutely shot aside with the struggles of Senga and the struggles of Peterson. And then obviously the injuries that started to mount, the Clay Holmes one being significant. But Sean Manaea is due 1 year at $25 million. As overpaid as he is, if you got rid of him, you'd need to replace him. And that is the going market for starting pitchers. It just is. So Sean Manaea is pitching his way into us having maybe a small level of confidence of him being in the rotation in 2027. But I think the finances are going to lead more to that. But he pitched well. 7 innings, 3 runs, only walked one guy. The error by Juan Soto was abysmal. But you know what I loved about the error from Juan Soto? And I didn't know this at the time. How could I? The very next inning, Soto hits that bomb of a home run, that majestic home run that turned a 6-3 game into what was eventually the final score, 7-3. Soto hits the home run. He poses, does the whole thing, and we all noticed it. He starts having a hissy fit in the dugout after he hits the home run. Our buddy Dan called it a bizarro Jeff McNeil situation, which cracks me up because McNeil would have a conniption over sucking, over popping up the second base, over grounding out. And for some reason, and I think we know the reason, Soto had a freak out after he hit a home run. But I am assuming that the freak out was about the error. And I like that. Because I know and you know, and you certainly assume the player knows, that errors like that are bad. They can't happen. Not good. You want to see a player give a damn about it. Because I think sometimes you hit a home run, you're up 7-3. It's like, ah, who cares if I made an error? That's Juan Soto taking his craft seriously. So I like that. I like that. I thought that was very, very cool. And Soto's locked in. You know, he still lacks the big moments, even though he gave us a huge one against Atlanta on Monday or Sunday, whatever day it was. I don't want to minimize that. So I'll rephrase it as he's given us a big moment. He has not had the consistent big moments. But man, he gets on base a lot. He gives you great at-bats. And when he hits a home run like that, I talked earlier about how when Lane Thomas hit the leadoff home run, it gives me flashbacks to Jeter. Soto hitting bombs at Citi Field gives me flashbacks to Soto hitting bombs at Citi Field as a National. So I love the fact he's on our side now. That makes me smile. So great job by Sean Manaea. Waskar Brazoban with a really good bounce back performance because remember, he was bad 2 days ago. And again, we saw the Met offense pick one inning to explode. This happened to be the fifth inning, 1-1 game, bottom of the fifth inning. Tyrone Taylor, who comes into this game after Vientos gets drilled. I'll get into that in a little bit as well. Taylor hits a home run, so he's been on kind of a power streak lately. Brett Beatty continues to get a base hit every day and also picks a nice spot to steal a base. A.J. Ewing with a base hit. Bo Bichette with a productive out, the sacrifice fly. And then clutch hitting by Carson Benj and Francisco Alvarez. So it turns from a one run, Mets tie the game up, bottom of the fifth inning on the home run by Taylor, 2-2. And they turn it into a big inning by scoring the five that they did. And obviously they win this game by a final score of 7-3. Let me get to Mark Vientos. I am not happy with Mark Vientos this season. Nobody is. I think our judgments on Mark Vientos are a lot more set in stone than maybe our judgments on a few other players on this team. With that said, that sucks for him. It does. He gets drilled by a pitch. He's got a fracture in his hand. He's going on the injured list. It sucks for him. I think that's just the best response we should have. It shouldn't be, who cares? We don't need him. We've all made our judgments on Mark Vientos. So the injury isn't about us having that delayed. It's that it sucks for him. And it sucks for him because I think there was a chance the Mets were going to sell him off at the trade deadline. Not for a lot. They weren't going to get anything of significance, but I think it would have been more of, we don't have a role for you. We don't know what that role would be. You've been wildly inconsistent. You're incredibly selfish on challenges too, which has been noticeable. Let's get you to a new slot. We'll take whatever we get back. You know, a quadruple A reliever. Obviously, that injury is going to derail that. And Mark Vientos is going to be on this team, I'd assume, post the trade deadline. And we'll see how long the recovery is. So it sucks for him, but it's funny how baseball works. Tyrone Taylor comes in, hits a home run, and gets a double. That's baseball, Susan.
I just wanted to say something because you're talking about trading and Vientos, and that sucks. I don't know if you saw the latest rumor that's going on right now. Or not latest rumor, but according to Will Salmon, Clay Holmes is open to working on an extension right now with the team so that he does not get traded.
Yes. Yeah. So when Clay got hurt, I remember we did that drive home, Rico, after that Yankee game. And I think we talked about how his career could be over here, especially if he doesn't pitch again. But then the idea of, would an extension make sense? Because it actually makes sense for both parties. Clay was proving he's a starter, but was going to miss a huge chunk of time. Now we're realizing it's going to be less than we thought because he's already throwing, could be on a rehab assignment soon. We could see Clay Holmes by early to mid-August. It's certainly on the table that we're going to see him that quickly. But at his age, with an opt-out, does it make sense for the Mets and Clay Holmes to just remarry? Look, if you're Clay Holmes, I know the Mets right now are LOL Mets and so many guys have regressed, and it's true. If you're Clay Holmes, you don't want to leave. Why would you want to leave? This is the organization that took a chance on you to be a starting pitcher. This is the organization where you've had that success. So I can see Clay Holmes wanting to be here. And if you're the Mets, why wouldn't you want him back? You need certainty in this rotation. And so maybe they are able to meet in the middle and work out a new deal. Let's say a 3-year, $66 million contract. I'm just throwing it out there. I don't even know if that would be enough with how well he pitched. But I know it fits the Stearns model that he's not getting 6 years. It's not going to be a long, long-term contract. And we saw him give a 3-year deal to Manaea. So do you go 3 years with Clay Holmes? I hope it happens. I don't think he'll be traded. I don't think that will happen. Also, I don't know if he'll be able to pitch prior to the trade deadline. So his value may be a touchdown. As far as Vientos, who should come up? I don't think it should be Ronnie Mauricio unless there's a commitment to playing Ronnie Mauricio. And there isn't. He's not going to play shortstop. He's not going to play third base. I'd play him at second, even though Beatty has been hot recently. That would be the spot, but they didn't do it. And DH right now is going to be occupied by Jorge Polanco. Vientos' playing time was already diminishing. He had lost the first base job to Jared Young, especially against right-handed starters. Against lefties, he would play. And now with the return of Jorge Polanco, he had kind of lost that DH spot. So I think Vientos' playing time, despite being in the lineup in this game, though it was at third base because they were giving Lindor a day, I think it was going to be very limited. So for that reason, I got a couple of options on guys I would call up. I'd think about Hayden Senger. I'd think about going third catcher. The Mets have used Alvarez at DH frequently. I like it. I don't mind it. And as I've always said, if you're going to use your catcher at DH, it would make more sense to have a third catcher. So I think Hayden Senger makes a lot of sense. You can go with an MJ Melendez return or a Nick Morabito return, because those guys could come up here and be bench pieces. Ronnie Mauricio should not be recalled to be a bench piece. That, to me, would not make any sense. Hoff, can you do me a favor and talk for 5 minutes? I'm getting a call from an airlines I need to take. So talk Met baseball for 5 minutes. Thank you.
Oh, I would love to. Hello? Listen, and I understand the reason why he does not want to bring up Mauricio. My biggest issue about Mauricio is they haven't given him a shot. Like, this season is going nowhere. So to his point, to Evan's point, where it's like you got to make sure that Mauricio's playing, why are we not playing him? Why are we're getting Brett Beatty, and I understand Brett Beatty currently right now has a 9-game hitting streak. I think he's still batting .218 with a 9-game hitting streak. You could tell me that Beatty's a better defensive player. Mauricio has not had a fair run. Vientos has had his time. Beatty has had his time. One thing we could all agree upon is those two guys have not worked out for whatever reason. So I think it's time to give Mauricio a little bit of run. I understand that he had an opportunity a couple of years ago, but then all of a sudden he gets hurt. It sucks. It's bad timing. That was maybe his shot, but it's not, though. Out of all the guys, I think he's the most talented. But I understand what Evan's saying, that might as well go the safe route, bring up Melendez. I don't want to see Hayden Senger up here. To me, you're just talking about another dead bat. I can't sit here and watch dead bats anymore. MJ Melendez, I know, is hitting home runs in the minor leagues. Does that really, like, do anything for us? Yeah, he could hit minor league pitching. He can't hit major league pitching. That's a problem. So if there's something out there, if there's some sort of hope for next year, because that's really what it comes down to right now. Are we not basing what we're going to watch? This season is done. I don't think anybody's going to fight us on that, and it's okay. It just is what it is. This season was done in April, you know? Is it now, like, it's two things. It's A, highlight players that potentially could do good and get you value back. And then B, it's let's see what certain players can do. Maybe this is the final hurrah. You know, does it make a difference if the team goes, you know, it gets wins in the 70s or low 60s? It doesn't make a difference anymore. It's about time we go and give Ronnie Mauricio that chance. So to me, I don't want to see Melendez. I definitely don't want to see Hayden Senger up here. I don't disagree. I think that Alvarez should get more play at the DH. I don't want to see Hayden Senger.
Why don't you want to see Hayden Senger?
Because he's a dead bat.
He's just to protect because you want to DH Alvarez. It's not he's gonna play a lot.
Good. MJ Melendez could do that, which I don't want to see him either. Let me just tell you something. I went and sold some people on Mauricio, and the reason why is this. I'm done with Beatty. Vientos is out forever for who knows how long, but they've had their run. I know that Beatty's on a 9-game hitting streak. He's still batting .218. I mean, what are we doing here with this guy? I think it's time to see Mauricio play a little bit of steady playing time, you know?
I get you. I think with Beatty, look, I would have given Mauricio the opportunity. I would have. They're obviously not doing that, which is why sending him down made a lot of sense. You know what Brett Beatty is earning? And I know we're going to do a lot more of this over the next few weeks and months because this is not a playoff team. It's not like we're breaking down a pennant race. A lot of it is evaluating where guys fit. I really believe what Brett Beatty is proving. If we can get past his prospect status, if we can just move on from that and understand he's never going to be a superstar, I think Brett Beatty is turning into a valuable bench piece. I really do, because he does a good job at second base. See, you're laughing, but you know what's unfair about your laugh off?
Go for it.
If he wasn't a prospect, if he wasn't a guy who was a first-round pick who we had high regard for, you would look at a player, even with a .220 batting average, and say, wow, you know what? He plays a decent third. He plays a decent second. He could play first. He could play the outfield. I don't mind that guy as a guy off my bench. See, right now the Mets aren't using him as a guy off the bench. He's the everyday second baseman with Marcus Semien out. I'm telling you, on a better roster, a more flushed out roster, Brett Beatty, a bat off the bench who could play four different positions, you can't tell me there isn't value to that. There's a reason why I'd rather have him on the team next year than Mark Vientos.
Oh, no. And I'm not going to fight you on Vientos. I don't need to see him ever again, too. His career could be done or whatever. Move him on to a different – sign him with the Ducks. I don't care. That's fine. I laugh because, it's called sarcasm. Sarcastic laugh. It's just funny.
Gotcha.
We're finding all – like, hey, Luis Torrens, great backup catcher.
He is.
Tyrone Taylor, great fifth outfielder. I mean, can we get the starting lineup down?
Relax. Obviously, we'd agree with that. I'm just evaluating the players and where they can fit. I said earlier with Vientos being hurt, it sucks that he got hurt. I don't see his role anymore. And I think a part of it is if you're not going to hit on a consistent basis, and Beatty hasn't either, by the way, but if you're not going to hit on a consistent basis, you need to bring a value to a team by doing things. Vientos doesn't play defense. He's not good defensively. His challenges are driving me nuts. And overall, as a team, the challenges of the New York Mets have been brain dead. Look at game three of this series, which we were in the midst of talking about. They ran out of challenges by the fifth inning, and Torrens is banging his head in the eighth inning saying, I'd like to challenge that. And the home plate umpire, Manny Gonzalez, is like, your schmucky team used all the challenges. Sorry, bro. And in a lot of ways, Vientos is the face of the ignorant challenges. Let me read some of your emails about game three in this series, and we'll pick the Rico, I'm the man right now, star of the series, and the net negative. Peter writes, hey, Evan and Hoff. Okay, I'm back in. How far out of the playoffs are we? You do not want me to answer that question. The New York Mets, with their win, improved to 40-54. They're 14 games under 500. The New York Mets are currently 12 games out of a playoff spot. A playoff spot. Sean is pissed off at the WFAN social media team for claiming that Zach Wheeler was traded to Philadelphia. Yeah, that was I don't know why they wrote that. I was making the point on the air today, and I mentioned it briefly here on the Rico, that if you look at what Seaver did in Cincy and what Wheeler did in Philadelphia, Zach Wheeler will be a better Philly than Seaver was a Red. Now, obviously, Tom Seaver was an iconic Met. I'm not comparing the emotions of trading Tom Seaver with letting Zach Wheeler leave as a free agent. I'm just telling you, based on what they did in their next location, Wheeler was better. Nolan Ryan, too, but I think Nolan Ryan is very different in that I don't know how people felt about that trade when it was made for Jim Fregosi. Like, was there a belief Nolan Ryan was going to turn into a Hall of Famer or be a superstar? I think with Zach Wheeler, there was. So anyhow, Sean was pissed off that the FAN social media team made that mistake. Let's go to Jimmy, who writes, how they've used the kids, Ronnie Mauricio, is mind-numbingly dumb. I was happy they sent him down so he could get reps. If Vientos is headed to the IL, the likely move would to be recalling Ronnie Mauricio. But for what if you're not going to use him? How about giving Ryan Clifford a couple of weeks? What's the difference? We could use a backup first baseman. Vientos hardly plays anyway. Bring the kid up and see if the bright lights flick a switch. The next time they call Ronnie up, they need to commit to giving him a shot. I agree with you. As far as needing a first baseman, they don't. Jared Young plays first base. Brett Beatty can play first base. And what we need to see is Jorge Polanco, who was brought here to play first base, is he capable of going out and playing first base? Jeff writes, watch out. The Mets have won 4 out of 5, and as of now, have the tiebreaker against the Braves. You're being sarcastic. I know it, and that's okay. All right, let's go to our buddy Howard, who always supplies the stats for the Rico, I'm the man right now, star of the series, and the net negative. I actually got some stats, too. I think offensively, first of all, for the I'm the man right now, credit to Sean Manaea, 7 strong innings. Credit to Christian Scott, the 5 scoreless innings. I think in a series in which the Mets go out and score 25 runs in 3 games, which is what they did, 12, 6, and 7 for their offensive output. Obviously, the 12 wasn't enough, but the 6 and the 7 were. I lean towards the I'm the man right now being an offensive player, and there are 2 guys that really jump out at me in terms of how they performed and how impactful they were. And what's so cool is that they're the youngins. It's A.J. Ewing and it's Carson Bench. A.J. Ewing ended up going 7-for-14 in this series with 2 home runs and 4 RBIs. Carson Bench, listen to this, was 6-for-9 with 4 walks and 2 RBIs. He got on base 10 times in 13 plate appearances. That is insane. Those 2 guys are clearly at the head of the pack in terms of being the men right now.
It's funny because I thought of 2 names. I did not think of Benj. I knew he had a good series. I definitely knew A.J. Ewing was incredible. I thought Juan Soto had a really good offensive series. Am I wrong about that?
Juan Soto went 2-for-10 with 2 home runs but drew 4 walks. So his 2 hits were both home runs, and he got on base a bunch. And he drove in 4 runs. So it wasn't a bad series, but no, it wasn't the statistical impact that A.J. Ewing or Carson Benj had.
Well, then it's got to be A.J. Ewing. If I had to choose between those two, I'm going to go A.J. Ewing. I think he just had a phenomenal series.
Despite Benj having a great series, and some of those at-bats, like those walks that he drew, were very impressive. Like, he had the 9-pitch walk in the 8th inning, which turned out to be the game-winning rally. So he was really in the midst of what was the difference in Game 2 of this series. But even though Benj was on base, which is, the fact he was on base 10 times.
Yeah, it's pretty stupid.
Like,
dude,
The numbers say bench, but I think Ewing overall was the star with the two homers.
And let's just – I've been so negative this entire season. I'm going to stop for 1 second and just say the Mets outfield right now is pretty fucking sick. I mean, Juan Soto, A.J. Ewing, and Carson Bench, I mean, this could be an elite outfield for years. And listen, Juan Soto still has his defensive flaws. But Ewing and Bench are defensively gifted, and their offense, it's not going away right now.
Yeah, and they're both getting better. That's what's really, really encouraging. I mean, both of them are evolving as the season goes on, especially Bench, because of the way it started. Like, it was such a bad start. We forget that there were literal discussions. We stayed away from it because I wanted to be patient on sending him down. On, hey, is he overwhelmed? Is he ready for the major leagues? And you've watched him get better and better and better and better every series, every game. There's no doubt the positive right now on a horrible season, because it is, let's not move off of that, is what they're getting out of these young outfielders. But it's closer between Bench and Ewing than I thought for the on the man right now. But I agree with what Howard wrote, and I agree with what you said. It is A.J. Ewing, 7-for-14 in this series. Two home runs. He's played a really stellar defense in center field as well. We even saw him move to second base in the last couple of innings, or actually early in the game, when Mark Vientos went down. As far as him playing second base is concerned, just a brief conversation on that. I think versatility helps you, and versatility helps the Mets. And so when the Mets are refixing this team during the offseason, it is very good to know that A.J. Ewing could be capable of playing second base. It's good to have that as a weapon, because you never know what the offseason brings you. You just don't. I mean, look at last year. Who thought they were going to be aggressively going after Kyle Tucker? We didn't see that coming. So I think the versatility of Ewing is fantastic. And if there are moments in a lost season to get him reps at second base, I am not against it. Just like if Luis Robert Jr. comes back and is somehow healthy, I'm not against A.J. Ewing playing some second base. Not because I envision him as the second baseman, not because I need Luis Robert Jr. in the lineup. It has nothing to do with that. It's about continuing him, Ewing, to work the muscle of playing second base, because you never know who becomes available and what makes sense for this roster. So let's just remain open-minded to the idea he can play the position. Do I view him as a center fielder? Yeah. Is it likelier than not that he's the center fielder for the next decade? Yes, I am not disagreeing. But the idea of him playing some second base this year to keep that possibility open, I am absolutely for. I am not against it. In fact, you talk about who to call up with Vientos going down. If you called up a Nick Morabito, that creates more opportunities for A.J. Ewing to shift over and play second base.
Yeah, it's weird. Like, that's the trend right now, is baseball players are not just a one position player. There are, it's utility. It's like, hey, can they play second base, third base, shortstop, first base, basically play all around the diamond. It helps their stock go up. But I like the comfort level of, this guy is owning center field. I don't have to worry about it.
You know? I totally get it. And that is the likeliest scenario. I'm just saying that him moving over to play some second base this season in a lost season, it's a good thing. And I think the reason I said Nick Morabito is, if Nick Morabito is playing center field and forcing A.J. Ewing to play second, you're like, oh, okay, all right, that's fine. If it's Luis Robert Jr., you want to riot. It's like, screw Luis Robert Jr. Ah! No, it's not about him. Okay, we all know Luis Robert Jr. is not going to be on the team next year. There's a $20 million team option. They are not picking up. But him coming back and playing, if he's healthy, every once in a while, is not a crime against humanity. It's okay. Now, the net negative. This is complicated, because I think there are three clear choices, and we have to decide between the three of them. And it all goes back to the abomination that was Tuesday night, when the Mets lost to the Kansas City Royals 16-12. It is one of these three pitchers that is the net negative, okay? Choice number one, Kodai Senga. 3 innings, 5 hits, 4 runs, 4 walks. He leaves the game with a big lead. Now, granted, he left the game up 9-4, but they took him out because he could only get through three innings because he's unpitchable. Then you got Austin Warren. Austin Warren did not record an out, gave up four hits and five runs, obviously blows the lead. And then the other option is Mike Seelinger. I think there is this belief that because Seelinger is a local kid who got DFA'd, it would be just piling on to say, oh, by the way, you're the net negative. Austin Warren's had a really good year and he's hurt, right? There's an injury attached to it. It would almost be mean-spirited to give it to him with an injury. So I feel like the emotion is just give it to Senga because he sucks. I'm sorry, I can't do that. I apologize. If we are being true to the net negative, okay, and we're going to take emotion aside, the net negative is clearly not Matt Seelinger. Good news. It's not him. It's Austin Warren. Mm-hmm. It just is. I mean, he came into a game up by five runs in the fifth inning and didn't get an out. Not one. Zero outs. Like, are you effing kidding me? Mike Seelinger, as much as we're going to give him crap, or Matt Seelinger, I keep calling him Mike, I apologize. After he imploded in his major league debut, then came out and at least pitched the eighth inning and didn't give up a run. Like, he actually got the Mets three more outs. I'm not putting him on Mount Everest here. I'm just Mount Everest on Mount Rushmore. We may stick him on Mount Everest. I'm not putting him on Mount Rushmore. I'm just merely saying, hey, there was at least something he did. Austin Warren, dude, I love you, man. I was talking you up a few weeks ago here on the Rico. I got to be fair to what the net negative is. He didn't get an out. The net negative, Pete, has to be Austin Warren.
See, and I agree with you on Seelinger. I'm not going to do it to the kid. There was no reason for him to be on this roster. Again, this is just confusing why he's even here. So I give him the pass on that. I don't know, man. Like, I understand your point about Austin Warren, but I'm sick and tired, and maybe this is the motion speaking here, but I'm sick and tired of Kodai Senga getting pats on the back for going out there for two and two thirds and only giving up one run. Like, this guy was a starting pitcher. He can't go an inning or two without giving up runs. That's embarrassing. Austin Warren, he's a relief pitcher. We know he's not going to give you length. He couldn't give you anything. But Kodai Senga, he just piles it on, man. So I'm Senga all day, bro.
You're saying it because, and I love you, but I've identified a flaw in Pete Hoffman. And it's okay. Your flaw is you cannot separate the season from the series. That is the problem. And
yes,
like Austin Warren, until his last few appearances, was having a great year. That was the comment I made on the Rico. I'd give him an A. Like, I can still look at Austin Warren and say, look, he's had a pretty good year. It just has gone horribly wrong here in the month of July. But he's the net negative of the series. Of the series. He didn't get an out. He came into a 9-4 game and gave up, let me look at my four hits and a walk and a hit batsman. He faced six batters and they all got on base.
With a blown elbow. With a blown elbow. Did he blow out his elbow? See?
Yes.
Look at
I'm sorry. Excuses or not, Austin Warren, for the very first time this season, you are the net negative. Congratulations to AJ Ewing. It is the second time in four series. He also won the I'm the Man Right Now in the series that the Mets lost to Philadelphia at Citi Field. So congratulations to AJ Ewing. You are the man right now. Three games coming up against the Boston Red Sox. Friday will be a doozy with Sonny Gray taking on Nolan McClain. I hope that we see Zach Thornton over the weekend. He got pulled the other day very briefly from his AAA start. And I think now that Zach Thornton has fulfilled his time in the minor leagues, he should come up and should get the rest of the season. I'll take it a step further. Like, he should get the baseball every 5 days. I don't know what you do with Kodai Senga. The option I gave recently is you tell him you want to send him down. If he refuses, I think you write the check to get rid of him. I think there are certain moments where you say, I'm giving up. There are certain moments when you don't. I remain pretty steadfast that I wasn't ready to DFA Sean Manaea, and I think there's a reward to that now. I don't know if there can be a reward with Kodai Senga unless he's willing to go down to the minor leagues, which is what he should do. All right, I'm going on vacation, but the Rico doesn't. So here's our tentative plan for Rico Bronias. When the series ends against the Boston Red Sox at some point on Sunday from the beaches of North Carolina, we will give you your traditional series recap, Rico Bronia. And then, if you are ready for it, Pete Hoffman, during the All-Star break, it returns the drunk Rico Bronia. And so I think the plan is on All-Star Tuesday, and I can't even tell you it'll be after the game because who gives a crap about the game? So it could happen in the middle of the game. Once me and Hoff are lubed up enough on Tuesday night of All-Star night, we're going to give it to you, your drunken Rico. The topic of at hand will be, and this is so perfect for a drunk Rico, a first half recap. All right. So we're going to give you, at least we'll try, a first half recap while completely wasted. And I'm telling you, this year, I'm going for it. All right.
You mean you're not going to drink a strawberry daiquiri?
Well, I may, but I may drink many other things as well. I will, of course, do it in a very polite way. I will do it with everyone taken care of. My wife will be sober, so the kids are taken care of. We always do this in a very responsible way. But the drunk yes. Rico returns on Tuesday night. If you want to join in and you are safe, get drunk too. I hear that the Rico is more enjoyable when that's the case. So,
yeah, I feel that same way. That's how I feel. We should definitely do it, though. Like, we need to start when, like, Soto gets his first at-bat in the All-Star game, I feel like. No? Is that too soon?
The problem is, because I'm on vacation, I can't commit to a time because I don't know the way things will flow. So what I would tell everybody is subscribe to the WFAN YouTube page. Obviously, if you consume the Rico via podcast, just make sure you're subscribed. You'll get it in your inbox the next day or that night. But it will be at some point on Tuesday night, the return of the drunken Rico. So two Ricos scheduled for you. Sunday at some point after the end of the Met Red Sox series, and then Tuesday in an unofficial, official drunken Rico first half recap. You can always email the pod, thericob@gmail.com, thericob@gmail.com. This was a long one for some reason. I have no idea. I blame American Airlines. I had to have a brief conversation with them. All good. Thank you for listening to another edition of Rico Bronia.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Rico Bronia podcast. It's amazing, isn't it? Make sure you download it now to keep it on you at all times.
As the U.S. men's national team takes center stage at a home World Cup, make sure you're listening to Call It What You Want, part of the CBS Sports Podcast Network, where you can join me, I'm Jimmy Conrad, alongside Charlie Davies, Tony Miola, Marcelo Balboa, and Benny Feilhaber throughout this tournament for previews, instant reactions, and analysis of every U.S. match. Then all summer, we're back every Tuesday and Thursday, covering all things U.S. men's national team. Download and follow Call It What You Want on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.